My name is Marvin Landsverk, and this session is William Blake's Vision of Job. And this is a part of a series this week on the wisdom books of the Bible and William Blake's response to them. And the series title is Seeing Wisdom, Hearing Wisdom, and Speaking Wisdom. And everybody needs a Bible and a copy of Blake's. Here. Start with a very brief story about this cheapskate. And I'm not talking about myself, Dave. You're looking at me. Who finally got around to throwing a party for his friends. And he was telling his one friend how to get up to his place because he had moved recently. And he says, you come to the apartment and you walk up four flights. I'm on the fourth floor and the apartment number is 5B. So you just take a right. And when you get to the door, kick the door with your foot. And then when it opens, push it with your elbow. And the guy says, okay, go up four flights, take a right, apartment number. But what's this weird stuff about kicking with my foot and pushing with my elbow? And the cheapskate says, well, you're not coming empty-handed, are you?
Oh, okay.
And that really is a motto. Blake doesn't say it, but it could be a motto for how Blake wants to read. It is, he says to scriptures, you're not coming empty-handed, are you? When you read the Bible, you bring all kinds of stuff to that. I mean, your experience, your intelligence, your own wisdom, and in particular, your imagination.
And your faith.
Yes, certainly. And by reading scripture sort of with something you bring to it, will it mean anything? I mean, this is fairly traditional even in certain ways. That, and especially Blake's imagery will be anything bound between two covers becomes dead books, dead letters, unless it's enlivened by something. I mean, and faith is as good a word as any that can make words mean something. And I mean, that's today what I'm going to continue to focus on is taking some of that imaginative energy and reading the book of Job. And I really wanted to do two things today, and it's impossible to cover both completely, but we can make a stab at that, is poke our nose in the book of Job to see what's there and what's going on there, and then take a look at one of Blake's responses to the book of Job, which is the handout that I gave you, and just to see some of the ideas that he has there in responding and what he's interested in that book. So I'll spend approximately half the time on the book of Job and half the time on Blake's Visions of the Daughters of Albion, which is the title of his poem that you have here in front of you. So if you could find Job in your Bibles that you've got in front of you. And I'm sure not many of you grabbed a King James Version, although that's the version Blake was working with. So when, and he's very interested in sort of, yeah, I need it. he was very interested in, I mean, the exact words that he was looking at. I mean, of course, he knew he was dealing with the translation, and yet sort of the literal. I mean, as a poet, he's interested in words and word spacing and word usage. So, I mean, in the translations that I use in my work, it is the King James, since that's the one Blake had in front of him. Although the one I have today, since we're going to be reading some of Job, I've just got the New Oxford, because it's a little more readable. So what I'd like to start with is just some general introduction commentary on the book of Job. As you would find, mean anywhere. Specifically, I mean, what I'm particularly interested in Job, because I'm looking at it with Blake's help, is the form of it and the language use in it. So I just want to talk a little bit about the form, the format, and do a little bit of reading and responding to what we see there. Paying particular attention to language and form. And just by way of introduction, Job is a fairly complex book for a couple reasons. One, that the state of the text as we receive it is a bit of a mess. Mess by in terms of what exactly is there, how the different pieces that have been put together don't exactly mesh very well together. So there's inconsistencies, and I mean a dialogue going, and all of a sudden someone's making a speech that doesn't even seem to fit in very well with, as if you were trying to read this as a coherent drama play. And scholars really, some scholars identify two Jobs in the book. There's the Job of the frame, that's at the beginning, the narrative frame that gives you the story at the beginning and the end of the patient Job. And that's the Job of I think that most people even think of when they think of Job. Job's the patient Job who's blasted, he's still patient, and at the end he's rewarded for his patience. And that's the, by the time this was written, an ancient folktale, so by Ezekiel, Job is mentioned as synonymous with patience. Then, in the book of Job, which, again, it's hard exactly to date, but scholars say it's sometime 6th century B.C., so later, you get an impatient Job, which comprises the heart of the book, that is, the middle part, the wisdom part, the dialogue part. So you've got a narrative frame telling the story. In the middle is this dialogue when the wisdom statements are presented. And that Job seems to be more impatient. He's the one that's shouting, that's cursing not God, but life that's caused him all this calamity, and is arguing with his friends. He isn't just sitting there and taking it. He's uttering speech. And that's, it's a long book, 50-some chapters. I mean, that's the bulk of the work. And so those two Jobs don't exactly go together perfectly with the patient Job, the impatient Job. Doesn't mean that they can't be seen in some sort of coherent whole. But it makes reading it interesting. And you could see with Blake's eye when he's reading the Bible, those of you come to the session yesterday or other times, Blake really, his view of the Bible was that it had been polluted by years of bad theology and by bad editing. That is, people with the wrong view of God, the wrong view of the world, had done the editing for it and messed it up. I mean, and when he reads the book of Job, I mean, not knowing sort of the dating and the things that scholars know about it now, he could still see some of that stuff. I mean, inconsistencies and coherencies that he was dealing with in his own poetic way. And his poetic way of dealing with that isn't the scholarly fashion, trying to date something and figure sources for all this, but to see different voices being uttered there and different visions of the world, and some of those visions he liked and some of them he didn't like. So that will be the way he'll respond to much of the Bible. And again, he'll always take something with him when he goes to that. So if you could take a look, we'll just read a bit of the Job. I mean, it's such a fascinating story. I mean, just sitting here and reading it to each other the whole time, I think I would be satisfied. I was thinking before I came, what we're really going to do today, is as we did yesterday, is talk about some very weird stuff. And today, and then we'll get to Blake. Because the book of Job, I mean, it is weird. I mean, here you've got someone who by the end meets God face to face and survives to talk about it. I mean, that's a fascinating story in itself. He's calling out, he wants God. God finally does show up and speaks to him. But some of the framing in this, let's just take a quick look at the narrative frame and then some of the form of the central body of this thing. I mean, I, as many of you know, teach English literature at Montana State University, and I teach a lot of poetry, and I mean, find myself drawn always to formal elements, and particularly to language use, the functional use of language, how words and sentences function in different ways. I mean, I'm not talking about grammar so much as mean, something that's sometimes referred to as speech act theory, which doesn't really matter what it's called for our purposes here. So let's just start at the beginning of the book of Job and get a feeling for what's going on here. Right at the beginning. There once was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. That man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil. There were born to him 7 sons and 3 daughters. He had 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 donkeys.
I can't
Sorry. 500 donkeys and very many servants, so that this man was great. So we get the establishment of this hero character who has wealth and also has faith. This is a man who loves God. In fact, he loves God so much that, as it goes on to say, on feast days when they had run their course, Job would send and sanctify his family, and he would say, "It may be that my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." So just in case they had done that, he went through the ritual prayers. And it's something I do to my kids in a reverse fashion. And every once in a while in the morning, I chase them around and say, "I'm going to spank them in the morning to just get it over with." Just in case they're naughty later. They know it's a joke.
He never carries through with it.
No. So there's the opening first movement. Job is this magnate. He's introduced. He's from the east of Israel. He's blessed by God. He's rich. And we know how this story happens fairly quickly. Second movement, one day God's in heaven and he praises Job to, I don't know what your translation says, Satan is the term here, although this isn't the gospel or later understanding of Satan. This is Satan as adversary, or this figure that ran around and kept watch to see if people were doing what they were supposed to be doing. So this isn't the personification of evil at this point in this story. Although the term Satan, again, as Blake's going to read it, is going to have all the connotations, meaning when he's reading his King James Bible. I mean, what do your translations say?
It says Satan.
Yeah, or... Okay, so Satan and God are having this conversation, and Satan's suggestion is that Job, I mean, this comes right out of the wisdom tradition and what we were talking about the other day about the principle of distributive justice. The wisdom tradition in the book of Proverbs is this confident wisdom that says the world is an orderly place. Because God's in charge, the world is an orderly place. And as long as God is in heaven, the good will be rewarded and the evil will be punished. Now, Book of Job is a confrontation with that wisdom. It says, I mean, Job's a good guy, he's punished, and then here's the mythic plot that sets up how that's happening. but Satan is putting this idea out, saying, I mean, thinking about the principle of distributed justice, is if the good are rewarded, I mean, and that goes on for a while, how do we know that the good would praise God and love God if they weren't rewarded? So that material possessions may be bribing these people to love God, and they might therefore not have true faith. So let's set up the test. So God says, why not? Go ahead, blast away, but don't kill him. And Job, I mean, the narrative frame here, I mean, it's wonderfully speedy fashion, starts to lose everything. I mean, and it's a horrifying story. I mean, if you're identifying with a character here, too, I mean, he starts to get these reports that comes in. So after this divine conversation, Satan's question, I mean, is the fascinating one. It's often defined as one of the most probing questions of the Bible in verse 9. Satan answered the Lord, "Does Job fear God for nothing? Does Job fear God for nothing?" Or, and he goes on, "Have you not put a fence around him and his house and all that he has on every side?" I mean, again, I mean, is what's faith is part of the question that's being asked there. Does he fear you, respect you, because of he's been given so much? So, one day, 13. When his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in the eldest brother's house, a messenger came to Job and said, Sorry. The oxen were plowing, the donkeys were feeding, and the Sabaeans fell on them and carried them off and killed the servants with their swords. I alone have escaped to tell you. So this is the start of a bad day. And so he's lost part of his wealth. While he was still speaking, another came and said, "The fire of God fell from heaven and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them. I alone have escaped to tell you." I mean now this isn't just enemies. This is some sort of calamity that can only be understood in terms of God's doing something. While he was still speaking, another came and said, "The Chaldeans formed three columns, made a raid on the camels, and carried them off and killed the servants with the edge of their sword. I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was still speaking, another came and said, "Your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their eldest brother's house, and suddenly a great wind came across the desert, a tornado or something, struck the four corners of the house, and it fell on the young people, and they are dead. I alone have escaped to tell you." And Job's response is what you might expect. He tore his robe, he shaved his head, he fell on the ground, and he worshiped. So his faith is intact in some fashion. Satan has said, "He will curse you." And the test begins, and he's passing the test. He says, here's some of his wisdom. "Naked I came from my mother's womb. Naked shall I return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." So there's patient Job enduring horrible calamity and enduring it with dignity and silence. I mean, there's some real interesting relationships set up already between this and the wisdom tradition, which can't be summarized in any sort of easy black and white fashion. I mean, a black and white version of this might say, the book of Proverbs, confident wisdom, orderly world, Job and Ecclesiastes, and that can't be true. This isn't an orderly world. The good aren't rewarded, only and only the evil aren't punished. And therefore, Job is going to reject the book of Proverbs and its wisdom. I mean, he rejects some of it, but throughout this, he's still quoting some of the Proverbs straight out of the book of Proverbs. So somehow, he'll retain some of the meaning of the wisdom tradition, but it won't be seen, again, you could say in a simple way, that just because he's good, he'll be rewarded. It must mean something else. And Job doesn't really explain, doesn't provide all the answers for how that can be. What it gives you is a portrait of the fact that it's not true, but that God is still in the picture. The conclusion is, if you're suffering, doesn't mean that therefore God doesn't exist. God still is around. And if you start to worry too much about, I mean, what kind of a God is this then that would toy with people in this fashion? I mean, that leads to some sticky questions as well. And that's really one of Blake's starting points in his response. I mean, he doesn't like the picture of a God who would do this to a faithful man. And knowing, I mean, his mythology, I mean, one of his conclusions, therefore, would be, this can't be God. The person that's doing this to Job can't be God. It must be the wrong God, somebody else. So that his starting point for reading this story will be that some of what's in here is wisdom, some of Job's response is right, and exactly what he likes we'll get to, but that this oppressor God who will toy with the creatures of the earth in a cavalier fashion can't be a vision of a deity that will mean something to him that he can take as part of his faith.
Well, he's not the only one that exactly thinks that way.
Right. So, as this goes on, Job survives that test, and then Satan says, "Okay, well, we've taken away his possessions and his family. He's still got a wife. Let's affect his body, and then see what happens. Then he will curse you." So that's when he's smited with boils and scabs and sits out on the dung heap with a potsherd and scratches himself and has absolutely nothing. And his wife comes up and says, "Why don't you get it over with? Curse God and die." Because anybody else would at this point. And that starts then the dialogue portion of the book of Job when, in a sense, it's like a play happens before your eyes that very much is written in a poetic form. And that's when Job starts to speak, those who say, well, that Job's not quite the same one of this folk tradition because it's not a patient Job anymore. I don't know exactly how to resolve that. There's a lot in here that I can't exactly resolve. But he starts to speak, and I'd like to talk about the form then of what happens in those speeches and look at some of the speeches. And I hope I'm not just going to lecture this whole time, because I'd like to read a few of those and see how you respond to those to set up what Blake is going to look at. So the poem begins, and Job's friends show up, and they sit down by him, chapter 3, I'm not sure exactly, but that's where it's sort of the break occurs. Oh yeah, right before that, his three friends show up, and they sit with him, and he's sitting in this terrible condition, and they sit for 7 days and seven nights, and no one says a thing. Suffering with a friend who's part of their community. And after this, finally, Job starts to speak. And then you get this series of speeches being made. And the real quick summary is that Job speaks, he gives a diatribe, a complaint, is cursing life and the day he was born, in very resounding terms. And his friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, take turns dishing out what they hope is helpful advice to him. So they say, basically, you're suffering here because something's wrong, and what they're thinking of is the wisdom tradition out of the book of Proverbs. If you're suffering, you did something. So they say, what did you do? You've sinned, and you're being punished. Figure it out, and then all these problems will be solved. So each one takes turns speaking, and then Job responds. And his response is, I haven't done anything. And his response really is a condemnation of the wisdom worldview of confidence. He knows in his heart he has not done anything. We saw him early in the frame worrying if his kids had done anything that they didn't know about, so he was giving ritual blessings to them, but he knows for himself that he hasn't done a thing, and therefore he's being punished without cause, which risks horror. That is, God isn't really running the place, or God is a God who we don't like very much. And he's not willing to go that far other than to say, life's a mess, I don't know what to say other than that. So you get this patterns, the three friends speak, he responds three times. Then another character shows up, which because he isn't involved in the pattern early on, he's saying more or less the same things. It may be a later addition too, but he's a character I'm not terribly interested in for purposes today. And finally at the end, Job has been saying, I want to talk to God. He's the one I need to talk to, not you with your platitudes who aren't giving me much help. And then God shows up in the whirlwind, and it is a legal scene where Job asks, I want to be put on trial here by God, and we'll see if I'm guilty or not. And God speaks to him, and then the consequence of that, Job has this experience. It says, I'm nothing. God is everything. Who am I even to complain? And I'll just close my mouth here. And he does. And there's a number of ways to interpret sort of what happens at the end of Job. And again, Blake's view, if this is a God that's not a very friendly God doing this, Blake's view of the end of the book of Job is God shows up angry and says to Job, stop complaining, stop whining, stop worrying about this. You can't understand me. You never will. So be quiet. I even think you can read a little bit, Blakewood, a little bit of guilt into that. God feels a little guilty for having blasted Job for no reason, so he's even angrier at, blame Job, because the God is sort of blaming him himself.
Blake said
that wasn't really the true God. So,
right.
So it's not God showing up at the end. It's this manipulator and this person who had power, or not person, but deity that had power that was being a manipulator. And it's not the true God. The true God
right.
would not have done that.
Right. I mean, and that's always, when Blake's going to look at that, that's always on his mind. And yet, anytime God is speaking, and there's the potential that the original version of the story is there in the words. And so, I mean, it's not that you can just reverse everything completely and say, that's not God, so you can dismiss everything God says completely, because it's in the scriptures, and God may say something that's revealing sort of the truth of the matter that's been edited in a improper way. Yeah, I mean, that's, editors are the bad guys for Blake. I mean, if I were translating this to my modern, I mean, as someone who's writing books, I mean, it makes sense. I mean, you write books, you hand them over to the booksellers and they chop them up. I mean that's true for writers today. They often hate editors. In the same fashion, when I'm swearing and looking for someone to complain about, I mean, as a university professor, it's the administrators. It's always their fault. So I'm cursing anybody during the day. It's those darned administrators for screwing things up. Anyway, to get to some of the language use then in this forms of the speeches, I mean, and I think this will jump right out at you when you start seeing them speak. So Job starts saying, I hate my life. This is terrible. I'm in chapter 3 now. I don't like what's going on. And let's see, which part was I going to read? I guess his first friend then responds to him, and that's Eliphaz, chapter 4, starting with 1, and I'll read about 7 verses here. Are you with me? Then Eliphaz the Temanite answered. So he's responding to Job, and he's dishing out Book of Proverbs wisdom to him. Basically, that's what it is. And he says, if one ventures a word with you, he's polite here, will you be offended? So they've been sitting there in silence for 7 days. Job starts to complain, and then his friend is saying, okay, I'm going to give you a little advice if you'll let me. He says, but who can keep from speaking? You have instructed many. You are a great man. You have strengthened the weak hands. Your words have supported those who are stumbling and have made firm, feeble knees. But now it has come to you, and you are impatient. It touches you, and you are dismayed. Is not your fear of God your confidence, and the integrity of your ways your hope? Think now, here it is, the principle of distributive justice. Think now, who that was innocent was ever punished? Or where were the upright cut off? As I have seen those who plow iniquity and sow trouble and reap the same. I mean, these are just paraphrases of the Book of Proverbs. By the breath of God they perish, and the blast of his anger they are consumed. Now here's some poetic language. The roar of the lion, and these are images that are used in Book of Proverbs too, and that Blake was using, for those of you here yesterday. The roar of the lion, the voice of the fierce lion, and the teeth of the young lions are broken. The strong lion perishes for lack of prey, and the whelps of the lionesses are scattered. And he continues going on, and he starts to ask a few questions of Job, basically saying, 17, can humans, beings, be pure before their maker? And he goes on to ask some questions. And the question really is, what did you do? Now, Job's reply is in chapter 6 and 7. And take a look at his reply. Job's answer, chapter 6. He says, oh, that my vexation were weighed and all my calamity laid in the balances, for then it would be heavier than the sand of the sea. So here's his lament. Therefore my words have been rash, for the arrows of the Almighty are in me. My spirit drinks their poison, and the terrors of God are arrayed against me. Now, here's what he says. Verse 5. Does the wild ass bray over its grass, or the ox low over its fodder? Yeah, that's what I want to ask you. Can that which is tasteless be eaten without salt? Or is there any flavor in the juice of mallows? Okay, so he asks a few questions there. What does that mean? he's talking sort of, I mean, what do you even call those things? Does the wild ass bray over its grass or the ox low over its fodder? I mean, what's the purpose of a question like that?
Well, why does that mean, did you think, does the wild ass want, whining, you know, like a kid would whine? Is that what it means?
Yeah. I thought if he was braying, he might be celebrating. I was thinking, well, if you're just eating what you eat every day, then why would you celebrate?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple possibilities even there. I mean, as he goes on, I mean, as Job says, my appetite refuses to touch them, those bad things. So bad food, they are like food that is loathsome to me. So here he is. I mean, this is tied into some of the Bible studies all this week about feasting and apocalyptic feasts and who eats on the mountain and who eats down in the dung heap and who eats this terrible feast. And, I mean, I think... I mean, just some terminology here. I mean, what you get set up here becomes the standard linguistic device used in the book of Job, which distinguishes it from the standard two-verse set binary proverb of the book of Proverbs. Book of Proverbs, confident wisdom tradition, two sentences stuck together in a binary proverb. Here, the most striking linguistic device used in the whole book of Job, and it runs throughout the whole thing. Every character in the whole book uses these, are those things. Which, I mean, for lack of a better term, I would just call them proverbial questions. They're questions that are asked using some of the concrete imagery out of Proverbs. They're posed as a question rather than an authoritative assertion. And yet, even so, these questions imply an answer. It's not just an open question that's asking for an answer that says, what happened? It's implying an answer. I mean, you know, you could call it a rhetorical question too. It's a proverbial question that implies its own answer. Does the wild ass bray over its grass or the ox low over its fodder? I mean, I'm not exactly sure, I mean, what he's thinking, but I take that as... I mean, those animals make noises before they eat, certainly, and then when they're hungry, they'll eat. And you go on, I mean, there's question after question in this proverbial open fashion. Now, we could go through and look at a lot of these. I just look at a couple more because we want to get on to sort of what Blake will do for this. But there's Job asking proverbial questions. And chapter 8, verse 11... Bildad, so the next friend that's going to speak in this first series of responses, he uses the same basic format for speaking wisdom here. So, I mean, it's interesting. It's not just that Job's going to ask questions and these other people will dish out answers, but they will ask proverbial questions as well. So 8, 11, if I've got my notes right. So Bildad gives a speech, and he's talking about biblical wisdom, book of Proverbs again. And then he says, can papyrus grow where there is no marsh? So here it is. Another one. I mean, what's the answer to that one?
No.
No. I mean, that one's real obvious. An obvious proverbial question which implies its own answer, and everybody knows. Can papyrus grow where there's no marsh? No. Can reeds flourish where there's no water? No.
So my answer over here was no, too.
Well, it may have been. I mean, maybe what Job was saying was, if ox are hungry and stick food in them, do they sit there and keep making noise, or do they eat?
I mean, that's true. Horses, you know, before you put it in the stall, before they eat, they're making lots of noise. You stick the food in there, and they're pretty
and
quiet.
Do you hear? So the answer was no to all
these. I mean, that's often the answer to lots of the questions in the book of Job is no.
So, because okay, that's what they're saying, can you eat things without salt?
No. Right.
Okay,
does a bear pee in the woods?
That's exactly. I mean, we do this all the time, so... I haven't found that one yet here.
What? Marvin says, we do all the time.
We use those types of questions.
Oh, I thought you said, what's eating corn?
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, we do all the time.
Oh, I do. Erase that part. Okay, so he continues with these proverbial questions. While yet in flower and not cut down, they wither before any plant. So then, I mean... something's happening in here like the riddle Proverbs in the book of Proverbs. I mean, there, and it's similar to proverbial question, whenever a riddle is posed in the book of Proverbs, the answer is given. Remember, some of you heard me talk about that. I mean, and here, these proverbial questions do imply an answer, and they're often single word answers, and the answer is either a yes or a no that's being fished for. So what this does is it sets up a dynamic then that will be continued right down to God. I mean, when God speaks, how does God speak? Surprise, it's the exact same format. I mean, and all these speeches are so wonderful. I'd like to look at them all, but we don't have time. But let's just take a look at what God says at the end when God has God say, which is...
Clear at the end of Joel, yeah. The last confrontation.
Right, so that's where I am now. I mean, it's just the friends talking before then and Job responding. And then God shows up in 38 to 41. And he starts asking these same type of proverbial questions. So the Lord answered Job, the beginning of 38, out of the whirlwind, "Who is it that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Gird up your loins like a man. Be a man, Job. I will question you, and you shall declare to me." So Job's been calling for this legal encounter, using legal terminology. I want a hearing. I want to be heard. You guys are giving me bad advice, bad wisdom, even though it's biblical. And then every once in a while, Job has come in, and he's not only complaining, he's actually said something very similar to what God already says in a confusing speech because it doesn't fit the drama. He's already said something that now God is saying to him. I mean, that's something that interested Blake. Is if Job already knew this, how come? I mean, just in 28, he says the same thing. Why does God have to come up and tell him what he already knew? And part of Blake's version is this is all sort of Job's dream, and this God that he's thinking of here is a projection of himself. So Blake illustrates the whole book of Job. I mean, and it's complicated, long, and very interesting. But Job is this old guy with this long beard. And God is this old guy with this long beard. They're the same person.
Not to Blake, not to Blake.
I mean, and that's his view of what's going on here. I mean, this God isn't God. This is a false projection. This is man created in God's image reversed. This is a God created in man's image, but it's not the real God. God starts asking these questions. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? I mean, these aren't quite all yes or no questions, but I mean, what's the answer to that? Right.
I don't know.
That's about all you can say. Beats me. Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. What's the answer to that?
It wasn't
me. Yeah, right. I mean, if there's any answer, the answer is God. And some of the riddle Proverbs in the book of Proverbs, remember, that God is a strong tower. God protects anyone who runs into him. I mean, the answer to those riddles is often God, and the answer to God's riddles is me. I mean, I did it. I did all this stuff, and you better recognize it. I mean, Blake will read all this as oppressive speech. I don't think we necessarily have to read it that fashion, but certainly it has a lot of that air to it. I mean, God is saying, "Listen, shut up." Or who shut the sea with its doors when it burst out from the womb? When I made the clouds its garden? So he asks this whole series of proverbial questions, and they go on and on, and it's wonderful poetry. He talks about the behemoth. He's created these monsters, and Job can't do anything about it. And Job's response, when God says, "Okay, now what do you say?" is, first of all, he says, "What am I supposed to say? I can't say anything." Then God goes on in another long speech, and Job's response is to say in 40, verse 3 through 5, here's Job's answer to God after more questions. Job answers the Lord, "See, I am of small account. What shall I answer you? I lay my hand on my mouth. I have spoken once, and I will not answer twice, but will proceed no further." He basically says, Which is, again, remembering what the book of Proverbs, wisdom, tells you to do, is exactly that. Don't speak. I mean, if there's any danger that you might be foolish, be quiet. Only the wise can speak, and in the wisdom, the sages, so some people can speak. God's wisdom speaks, this personification. But most of those Proverbs say, be quiet. And here's Job sort of ultimately following that. I mean, it's not clear why he's being quiet even here. I mean, is it because he's faced with this huge oppressor who's telling him to be quiet, so he does? Or, I mean, has he internalized this wisdom? I mean, he's had this encounter with, I mean, any encounter with the Almighty in any mythology is cataclysmic, and most of the time you die. I mean, 99.9% of the time you die. It's only the big heroes that don't. So he doesn't die. I mean, that says something for Job right there. So just the final point about this, the linguistic form being used here, the proverbial question. I mean, one of the ways those questions function in this are as sticks to beat your opponents in the debate over the head with. That is, isn't it obvious, every one of those questions can be summarized as, isn't it obvious, Job says, all his proverbial questions are, isn't it obvious that I'm innocent? And Job's friend's response is, isn't it obvious that you've sinned? So every one of their proverbial questions, that's what they're implying. Isn't it obvious that you've sinned? I mean, the answer to them is yes. Job's, isn't it obvious that I haven't sinned? His answer is, should be obvious. And this, but his friends are saying no. So they get into this yes and no shouting debate. It's you did, you didn't. God shows up. Isn't it obvious that you're a pipsqueak and don't know anything about this?
And I'm the great creator.
I'm God. And Job doesn't even really say yes. He just falls into silent submission. So the speech acts used in Job really are weapons of power and authority to impose a worldview. Okay, so to turn to how Blake thinks about this, with the time we've got left.
Well, I can see why Blake didn't like it.
Yeah, I mean, especially with that summary.
I've been trying to understand Blake with you, and he's a very confusing person. But I'd like to identify with one little piece anyway, that this can't be God. God just can't behave like that.
And I mean, I was going to say, I mean, the narrative frame at the very end then, in 42, if you could take just a quick peek at that, I mean, where you get the final summary. Here's the narrative frame then, where it says, oh, Job answered the Lord and says, I know you can do all these things. Therefore, I've uttered what I did not understand, things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. Hear, and I will speak, I will question you, and you declare to me. I had heard of you by the hearing of the ear. This is the conclusion here. But now my eye sees you, and I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes. That's not a uplifting moral either. I mean, you're so big, I'm so small, I'm nothing, and I repent. But that line, look at that one, and then look at the opening of Blake's. He says, I had heard you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you.
Where are you?
Now, I'm on the front page, and you can look at the picture, the title page. Oh, you need one? Yeah. The title page of Blake's illuminated book, and this is in color. I don't have a facsimile of this one with me. I have some slides that I'm not going to show them because I want to take a look at this. But this is in color. It's an etched plate where he's etching the designs and the text on the same page, and he did this in 1793, so that's where we are. And he likes Proverbs, as I've been talking about all week, and he puts them everywhere, so he sticks a proverb on the title page, and you can see it down at the bottom. It's hard to read. But it says, the eye sees more than the heart knows. And if you're looking, I mean, again, if you look over in the right, there's just the TypeScript version of this. It's right up there at the top, under the title, the eye sees more than the heart knows. Now there's I mean, what does it mean? That can mean a number of things, but one thing that I do, I would throw that line beside this one in Job. I mean, here's Job saying, I had heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you, and that means something to him. And Blake is saying, the eye sees more than the heart knows. So somehow there's a difference between seeing something and knowing it. That would be one way of looking at that, and more than one, and perhaps we can figure out what that proverb means by the time we take a look at a little bit of this. But ultimately, for Blake, to ask the question, what does it mean, isn't his big question. I mean, what something means isn't as important as how it means. How the language is used is what counts. I mean, and think about this in terms of proverbs. You can collect wisdom, stack it up, stick it between the covers of a book, and bonk people with it, and it will serve no purpose in his view of wisdom. The whole point of wisdom is to make more of it. So what he does, he writes new proverbs, and he continues to write them, and as he writes them, he throws them away. He's hoping, ultimately, that they never get stacked up and quoted to other people, that other people should follow. He's just constantly using them, and when he uses them, they function in all kinds of ways, but as language bombs again. So you say a proverb, things happen. And happens when anybody says a proverb because they're authoritative speech. I mean, there's no more authoritative speech than a proverb. I mean, it ends debate. Does the bear do it in the woods? Debate over. Answered question. I mean, that's what's being used in the book of Job. You ask that question, it's obvious, no one has to talk about it anymore. Blake's fascinated by that power of language, because that's the power of God in the book of John, as we were talking about at the opening in the Bible study this morning. So he'll stick them in there in ways where things happen. And what he does, I mean, I need to talk a little bit. I mean, what we really need to do is just read this thing. It's fairly short, but we don't have time to read the whole thing. But we'll read a little bit of it. And, I mean, this is a response to the book of Job. Now, by saying that, that's not the only thing it is. It's poetry. It's a metaphor. He's saying, okay, let's do some reinterpretation of Job. But, I mean, there's a lot of scholarly interpretations of this that never even mention Job. So, I mean, it's certainly not the only thing going on here. I mean, it's me who argues that you really can't understand this unless you do see the relationship with Job.
There's a senator, I don't remember which one, in Congress who is using Shakespeare, quoting Shakespeare.
Wedderburg.
Is that putting with legislation? He's almost doing the same thing, because the Shakespeare piece sort of puts in... ends the debate, sort of, of what that's about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Are you,
Robert, I should say.
Yeah, you quote the authority. So let me just give you a little bit of details about what's going on here, and you could see the connection to Job fairly quickly. Some of it's a bit weird, but the main connection between this and the book of Job is the form of speech used here. This thing is full of proverbial questions. I mean, you look everywhere, and I get mine all underlined, but everybody that talks in here asks proverbial questions. Now, Blake doesn't like people bonking each other over the head with authoritative speech acts. So what this really becomes is a parable of proper sententious utterance. Now, I'll explain what I mean by that. What he's doing, he's giving you a story. So he reads Job and he says, wow, I can relate to a lot of this. Some of the things are wrong, but I really like those proverbial questions. And he likes them, but he doesn't really like the way they're used in here, because they're used in the wrong fashion. But he can see, because he knows that the proverb is the speech of God. I mean, that's the performative. That's God saying, let there be, and there is. And God speaks, and in the mythic frame to the book of Proverbs, we know when God speaks, what is it? It is Lady Wisdom. I mean, God's speech is Lady Wisdom. Wisdom is God's speech. So those two things go together. So Blake tells this story, I mean, in the form of a parable, like Jesus' stories, about how to speak. And you get characters in here that speak incorrectly and characters that speak correctly. And instead of following Job so that everybody's speaking proverbial questions, only the good guys in here speak proverbial questions. And their proverbial questions are slightly different from those in the book of Job, where they're just used to climb on top of the heap. Blake's proverbial questions are like the ones he used in his other book, The Marriage, Feminine, Hell, that are open-ended questions that imply an answer, but not a single answer. They imply all kinds of answers, and that's where you bring something to the party. You don't just bring your yes, sir, no, sir answer. You bring your imagination and say, what in the world does that one mean? So, the mythic frame for this comes right out of the book of Proverbs, too. This sounds a little bit strange, but what he's doing, he's telling a story. And the story's telling, you don't have to know very many characters' names here, so I'll just give them to you. One's named Uthun. She's the woman on the front here. She's the good guy. And Blake is an early feminist. Feminists like her because he's celebrating feminine sexuality and feminine liberation from oppression to a great extent. So Uthun's this figure. Think of her as Lady Wisdom, and you really understand what her function is. She's the ancient consort of God. She's wisdom. Then there's two male figures in here. One's called Theotormon. Theo, God, Tormon. He's a tormented god. He's the god here that's really in charge, but it's not the real right god. So the relationship you have here between Uthun and Theotormon is a bad version of what the relationship between God and Lady Wisdom should be. That's the basic plot here. When God and Lady Wisdom get divorced or have a fight, and God is separated from Lady Wisdom, the world goes bad. And that's basically what his myth is saying here. And there's one other character that's involved in this sort of love triangle. It's an odd relationship, but his name is Bromion. It's interestingly connected to the term bromide. When you give someone bromides, you're giving them sort of platitudes and sort of proverbial wisdom. And the basic plot of this is Uthun is celebrating her life and liberty, and she is attacked by Bromion, who rapes her or something. It's the sexual attack, and then he throws her away and says, oh, you're now a prostitute because you're no longer a virgin. So Lady Wisdom, you can think about the terms from the myths in the book of Proverbs. Lady Wisdom is paired with Dame Folly. Dame Folly is the street prostitute. And now, from the position of the person who corrupted her in his eye in the first place, she's been converted from Lady Wisdom into Dame Folly, and she's a prostitute. And he throws her away, says, you can have her back, God, Theotormon. And Theotormon says, I can't have you back. You're no longer a virgin. You're damaged goods. So she's going along throughout this whole poem saying, I'm still who I am. It's not my fault. This is an interesting parable. Just a rape parable for today even. I'm still my own person. It wasn't my fault. I love you. I understand sort of God and God's wisdom because I personify it. So lighten up, God, Theotormon, take me back. And he can't. So, this doesn't end happily. So what happens in the parable that you get here is that each character speaks in a different way. Uthun speaks proverbial questions. And I'll just show you where these are. This is not going to have as much time for you to respond to this as I hope. But let me just show you what she's doing here. This is on page 47. At the top. So you get the setup to this that tells you what's just happened. She's just been raped and thrown away by Bromion, who taunts her. Theotormon, now she's gone back to, says, here I am, I'm okay, will you help me? And he says, no. So she says, why does my Theotormon sit weeping on the threshold? And Uthun, she's speaking of herself in the third person, hovers by his side, persuading him in vain. I cry, arise, O Theotormon, for the village dog barks at the breaking of the day. So she goes on in this actually biblically inspired speech. And then, in the middle there, where it says plate three, she starts asking questions. With what sense is it that the chicken shuns the ravenous hawk? There's the proverbial question. And in this work, she's the only one that asks those. And Blake is getting this right out of Job because he likes these things. But that one, what's the answer to that? With what sense is it that the chicken shuns the hawk?
No power. The chicken doesn't have the power.
No, what I was talking about is when a hawk flies over, why do chickens run inside the hen house? Yeah, and how do they know? I mean, it's the sense before they even see it, they feel it. I mean, that's as good an answer. Instinct.
With what sense? I'm asking, how does that chicken know?
Yeah. With what sense does the tame pigeon measure out the expanse? So you've got a tame pigeon, its wings are clipped, and they grow. With what sense is it that it's never flown before in its life, takes off and flies away? With what sense does the bee form cells? Have not the mouse and frog ears and eyes and sense of touch? Yet are their habitations and their pursuits as different as their forms and as their joys? And she goes on saying these proverbial questions, which imply their own answer, but it's not a yes or no. And the next character to speak is at the bottom is Theotormon. I mean, this is her, this should be, in the right way of things, this should be God if she's wisdom. But this isn't God because the world's fallen and this guy is not got things right. So what he says, he doesn't ask questions. He doesn't ask proverbial questions. He makes demands. And this is the speech act parable here. He just gives her commands. Tell me what's night or day to one overflowed with woe. What he does is give a bunch of lamentations some of them straight out of the mouth of Job when Job's doing his lamenting. Tell me what's thought, what substance is it made out of? Some of these questions he's asking, again, are right out of God's speech at the end of Job when God's saying, did you make this stuff? I mean, here he's saying, I don't know this stuff. If he's God, he should know that. I mean, he should know the answers to all these questions, and he doesn't. And he's expressing wisdom in the wrong form. So Theotormon is not wise, so he can't speak wisdom. Bromion, the next guy, the rapist, speaks next on page 48. So you see one line about 12, 13. Then Bromion said and shook the cavern with his lamentation. What's interesting in here, he can ask questions that are more closely approximating proverbial questions. He's better off than the god here, even though he's the rapist. And in one of Blake's proverbs is active evil is better than passive good. So in some mythic sense, the perpetrator here is better off, but he's not saying he's good, than this passive God who will sit by and do nothing while someone suffers. And see the connection to Job here. I mean, he's connecting this Theotormon to some extent, both to Job and to the God that would stand by when someone else is tormented. I mean, it all gets wrapped up into an untidy package. But just to wrap up here. So Bromion starts to ask questions, but they're perverse proverbial questions.
Perverse?
Well, they're the wrong kind. They're the ones that have yes or no answers out of Job. So he says,
Right.
The form's almost right, but it's not quite. So he says, are there other sorrows besides those of sorrows of poverty? Are there other joys besides the joys of riches and ease? And here's the clincher. Is there not one law for both the lion and the ox? And we know from Blake's writings elsewhere, that's one of his proverbs, one law for the lion and ox is oppression. The law of distributive justice from the book of Proverbs is an oppressive law, because it can be used to justify keeping people poor. If you're poor, you deserve it. God doesn't like you much. And here, Bromion is saying, isn't it true that the book of Proverbs is correct? There's one law for the lion and ox. And we know from Blake that that's not true, so he can't be speaking wisdom.